dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1, KFAR Knoxville 90.9, and hello to Free Radio Olympia 91.3. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Do you have a right of free speech if the only way you can use it is in ways that don't offend the government? Do you have a right to assemble freely to demonstrate your disapproval of government policies if you're only allowed to do this in such a way that it has no impact? This week on the program, we'll look at the extent to which our constitutional rights are actually respected, the freedom to speak, to hold views, and freely associate with others, to demonstrate, to be protected from cruel and unusual punishment, and to have one's person or belongings safe from arbitrary search and seizure by agents of the state. These are the American freedoms that we are told are being protected by the endless war. We'll report on new developments in the court case of four teenage peace activists in Ithaca, then on Abu Ghraib, USA. In our second hour, a lesson on your rights and how to protect them while protesting, especially geared towards listeners headed to New York City to protest at the Republican convention.
When the pot-bellied thieves chase their unwelcome guests.
I'd like to start out by reading you a brief article that was published by Associated Press on August 21st. John Rabbi reported from Charleston, West Virginia, on a graphic designer fired after heckling Bush. Rabbi wrote, "A man who heckled President Bush at a political rally was fired from his job at an advertising and design company for offending a client who provided tickets to the event. The fired graphic designer said Saturday he won't try to get his job back. I'm mad less about losing the job. I'm more mad about the reasons," said Glenn Hiller, 35, of Berkeley Springs. "All I did was show up and voice my opinion." Hiller was ushered out of Hedgesville High School on Tuesday after shouting his disagreement with Bush's comments about the war in Iraq and the search for weapons of mass destruction. The crowd had easily drowned out Hiller with its chant, "Four more years." "He surrounds himself with people who support him," Hiller said of Bush. "Your opinion is viewed as right or wrong." When he showed up to work at Octavo Designs of Frederick, Maryland, the following morning, he said he was told he'd embarrassed and offended a client who'd provided tickets to the event, and that he was fired. The client was a public relations worker who represents the Berkeley County School District. "It's just bizarre that you disagree with them and it all turns to evil," Hiller said. Messages left with Octavo Designs were not immediately returned. The father of two young girls had worked at the design firm for 5 months. He doesn't plan to appeal the firing and holds no grudge against his boss. "To some degree, I can see her point of view," Hiller said. "Advertising is all about having the perfect tan and driving a cool car. It's all about image." Hiller said he now plans to pursue work as a registered nurse, a field in which he worked for 10 years before landing the design job. Last month, Charleston City Council apologized to two protesters arrested for wearing anti-Bush T-shirts to the president's July 4th rally. The pair were taken from the event in restraints after revealing T-shirts with Bush's name crossed out on the front and the words "Love America, Hate Bush" on the back. Trespassing charges were ultimately dismissed. And that from John Rabbi of Associated Press. Interesting to note the language in the article, that all you have to do now to be described as a protester is to wear a t-shirt with an anti-Bush message. This sounds like something out of Nazi Germany, but sadly, it's all too American. 7 years after the signing of the Bill of Rights, the sainted Founding Fathers passed the Alien and Sedition Acts, which provided up to 2 years in jail for any speech or writing or involvement in such that would bring the government, the Congress, the President, or the laws of the United States into, quote, contempt or disrepute. Eugene Victor Debs, founder of the American Railway Union, 5 times a presidential candidate, was jailed for opposing U.S. involvement in World War I. He got almost 1 million votes while in federal prison in 1920. Many people have been imprisoned for advocating such things as labor unions, birth control, or the abolition of capitalism. What all these outlawed forms of dissent had in common was they threatened the social hierarchy of wealth and privilege and the national policies preferred by the privileged. In the 1950s, the Ku Klux Klan was on a rampage of murder and arson against black people. But meanwhile, the government was busy hunting people who were or had been communists, or who were sympathetic to the ideology of communism. None of these people had killed anyone, but they were in favor of the redistribution of wealth in the United States.
Billionaires for Bush.
Now, it's time for this billionaire moment.
Give a small child a knife, and the poor tyke is likely to chop off a finger. But in the hands of a master chef, that same knife is a tool for creating a magnificent, sumptuous feast. It's the same thing with money. Give money to poor people, and they'll probably squander it on foolish indulgences like aluminum siding, or medicine, or food. But if you put money in our hands, in the hands of people who have been around money all our lives, we're going to use that money to build empires and buy elections and develop weapons systems and suppress dissent and spread the blessing of unbridled corporate power all over the world. I'm Xenophobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here come the billionaires!
Last Tuesday, 4 teenage peace activists were in Tompkins County Court in Ithaca to appeal a conviction stemming from a die-in at a military recruiting center in December 2002. 13 people had been arrested and charged with criminal trespass, a misdemeanor, after they lay down in the lobby of the recruiting center in Lansing, New York, and refused to leave. The charges of the 9 adult demonstrators were later reduced to a violation, a charge similar in severity to a traffic ticket. But the 4 teenagers, Anna Ritter, Marie DeMott Grady, Una Grady DeFlon, and Anna Grady Flores, were tried separately on the heavier charges under a New York statute dealing with, quote, youthful offenders. Tompkins County District Attorney George Dentes refused to grant the 16- and 17-year-olds' request to be tried with the adults. In the end, the 4 received a heavier sentence than their adult co-defendants. The activists' appeal raised 3 issues. That the charge, criminal trespass, did not fit the circumstances and was improperly laid. That the elements needed to convict on that charge had not been proven by the prosecution in the original trial, and that the youthful offender statutes had been improperly applied by the district attorney. Lance Salisbury, who was representing the protesters, told Judge John Sherman that this had violated his client's constitutional rights.
And here it's clear that the statute was applied inappropriately. And I think it's important, I have to cite from, because it's unusual that you see such a clear elucidation by people in their brief of exactly why they did this. What we had happened.
I think it's clear that people wanted to avoid a jury trial.
Correct.
Okay, that seems evident. The question is this, counsel. Is the mandatory provision that's contained in the criminal procedure law, and it's really in anyone cites the statute, this is the one that really controls, is 340.40 subdivision 7, which makes it mandatory that an apparently eligible youth be tried before a single judge. Is that waivable? Is that what you believe?
No, Your Honor. It's the problem is in the application, how they applied the law. What they did was they charged the adults with a violation, and they then went on and charged the defendants with a misdemeanor. And then they seek to stay behind that statute, saying, well, we're forced to have an on jury trial, when in fact all the defendants could have been charged with trespass, the non-criminal violation. They all would have received the exact same treatment in a non-jury trial. The reason they chose to do so was disparate treatment based on their age. This is where you get the impermissible application of the statute.
Further, documents filed in the appeal proceedings confirmed what activists had said at the time, that the Republican DA's goal was silencing the protesters' anti-war message. Lance Salisbury.
The four in this case were charged with a misdemeanor because they could then apply the youthful offender statute to deny them still the right to a jury trial. And they specifically stated, because the four appellants here are youthful offenders, they don't have the right to a jury trial even with a misdemeanor, so there's no reason to charge them differently. So it's very clear their charging decisions were made upon the age of the defendants and how they could treat them disparately because of that. And what we were pointing out was that they made, and it's clear in their motions to the court, the trial court, they were making the argument that we're deciding how to charge, who gets charged with a misdemeanor, who gets charged with a violation based on age. That they were misusing the statute because they, well, if we charge the four youthful offenders with this, we can use this then to deny them a trial and to avoid giving the adult defendants the right to a trial, we're going to have to charge them differently. And that's disparate treatment based on age. So it's the application of the statutes that we're arguing there. And it's clear, they were clear in their motion, they specifically state their goal was to not deny people a jury trial, and they were worried and opposed to the political message of the people who were in the demonstration. They were making this decision based on the political nature of the case. They specifically stated that if and I'm trying to quote them, that it became clear to the prosecution that the defendants were seeking a forum to further expound upon their political beliefs, and that therefore their goal was to deny the defendants a jury trial. And that then was the basis of how and why they chose to charge people. Because the adult defendants had a right to a trial if charged with a criminal charge, they were then recharged with a simple violation where no citizen has a right to a jury trial.
Is it within the legitimate discretion of a prosecutor to level charges for an offense based on whether they agree or disagree with the politics of the defendant?
Well, the prosecution has a great deal of discretion in how they charge people. We would submit that that's very dangerous grounds, irregardless of whether you agree with the political beliefs of the appellants here or not, that it's very dangerous grounds when you begin to use political rationales as a charging basis, that you're really getting into dangerous ground. I mean, in the argument I always make to colleagues is, well, let's reverse the situation. You know, let's say that the president wasn't going to go to war, and these were four protesters who wanted to go to war and did the same thing. Would you still approve of a politically motivated basis for how they were charged? And most people would say no. You know, you have to kind of set the statute of justice is blindfolded for a reason, that justice and the rule of law is supposed to be impartial and blind to who the parties are in their standing, their economic background, their political beliefs. And that's why it becomes very troubling when you see specifically so explicitly stated that we're making charging decisions based upon what we think the political motives of people are.
Well, in your experience, how does the actuality meet up with the theoretical blindness of justice regarding the economic status, the political beliefs, and et cetera, of people under the law?
Well, it's been noted by the American Bar Association. I think many commentators that the more money that you have, of course, the better legal talent you can hire, the more money you can spend. So, there is a basis there for the fact that if you're well off, you do prevail. Oftentimes, you're better off in the legal system. And the legal system has safeguards it tries to provide to try to balance that out. There are questions on, at times, whether it works as well as it's supposed to. There's been a lot of commentary on that. But certainly I think most people would acknowledge that your treatment, even if it's unintended, the more money you have, the better your representation and the better off you are. When I looked at the case, I was troubled by how the prosecution went forward. I felt some of the other cases that were going on at the same time may have impacted upon them, and I was disturbed by the different resolution, how the adult defendants were treated differently, received a lesser sentence than the four defendants here, who had no criminal history, had engaged in purely peaceful activities.
The deputy DA, Andrew McWilliam, argued that the harshness of the sentence was a result of the defendant's refusal to pay the fine imposed by Lansing Town Judge William Burren at the original trial.
Each of the defendants were initially sentenced to a fine along with a condition of discharge. They refused to pay the fine, and that is within the discretion of the sentencing judge if they refuse to pay a fine. There's been no discussion that I've seen of any informal paupers or inability to pay due to financial constraint. If that's the case, the sentencing judge does have the discretion to sentence to incarceration. And I believe that my understanding of case law is it's within the sentencing judge's discretion to sentence to one day for each dollar that the defendant refused to pay. Certainly that's not the case here. I think that any harshness in the resulting punishment was brought on by the defendant's own refusal to pay a lesser fine and take the conditional discharge.
They sentenced us to a fine.
Defendant Anna Ritter.
Because they said they found us guilty. But we were there, we pled not guilty, because we didn't believe that we were guilty of causing any harm to anyone. We're in a public place and we didn't want to pay a fine to the court to say, yeah, you're right, here we are, we're guilty. And we weren't going to cooperate, and so we refused to pay. Really, I guess they can come to your house and take you to prison or jail, and, it's not really, a question of cooperation or uncooperation. Paying a fine, we would definitely be cooperating. By going to jail, we would be doing the least amount of cooperating.
I've spent a great deal of time working overseas in the third world, and whenever you see people being treated inappropriate by the law, I find that troubling.
I asked Salisbury whether his own beliefs played a role in him taking this case.
I worked in Somalia in the late 80s. Worked in Liberia in 97 and 98, and then in Bosnia and Kosovo from 99 to 2001. And much of the work there was civil society work. Work a lot in what they call post-complex emergencies, rebuilding societies. So I was dealing with a lot of societies that had authoritarian governments, and you'd seen the misuse of the rule of law and lack of rule of law. So a lot of my work was trying to reinstitute civil society and help people get back to where they'd been prior to conflict situations.
it seemed from what you just said that you were intending to juxtapose the idea of the rule of law as being something that stands in opposition to authoritarianism.
Well, ideally, rule of law is one component of a democratic society. And rule of law gets tossed around a bit, but particularly the concept that there's a legal system that people have access to that treats people fairly and blindly, in the sense that people aren't treated differently because of their background, economic, social, political. Those types of foundations are very important. And that when you look at a lot of these societies, it's oftentimes it's a gradual movement and erosion away. You don't even realize what's occurring until you come in, after 10, 20 years of this, and you see where they're at.
It's really important that we all keep working for justice and doing everything we can every day. Since the war started, thousands of Iraqis and hundreds of U.S. soldiers and other international soldiers have died, and that would have been preventable. It was preventable. If the war hadn't started, those people may still be alive, and their families have all suffered because of that, and still more people are going to die because of the war, and we really have to stop that. If we look at all the evidence, since then, it's come up with the absence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and all the people telling Bush that there weren't any weapons, it becomes clearer and clearer that really war wasn't necessary. And it's sad that we weren't listened to, because, it was one small action that we did, and really it was nothing compared to the suffering of just us spending a little time in court every once in a while. Is nothing compared to the suffering that all these people have gone through in this war.
The judge's decision is expected within the next 2 weeks.
Now, it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
Protesters are demanding we bring our troops home from Iraq immediately, but we can't do that. You see, the Iraqis are very hospitable, and the new leader we selected for them has asked our troops to stay. If we brought them home now, we would risk insulting our hosts. And then who would be there to keep an eye on things while we extract our oil from below their soil? And there have been complaints about American mercenaries torturing Iraqi prisoners, but who are you going to trust to soften them up so they can lead us to all those missing weapons of mass destruction? The government? Or a private security firm that can do the dirty work more efficiently for less money with less accountability? Privatization. It works. I'm Zena Phobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here come the billionaires!
Around the time the Abu Ghraib prison torture scandal hit the news, I was in the Bush Must Go office in Ithaca talking to a guy who was volunteering there. He told me he'd served in the military during the Korean War period. Responding to the way the scandal was being presented as the work of a few twisted individuals, the man wondered where the military had got such people, as he was sure that the military of his day would never have had such sickos. Well, here's the answer to his question of where the military got people willing to engage in sadistic and perverted acts against prisoners. It got them from the U.S. prison system. Reporter Anne Marie Cusack has been investigating torture and abuse in American prisons for 8 years. She spoke with Ron Anichich of CKLN in Toronto about her July article in the Progressive magazine titled Abu Ghraib, USA.
I've been reporting on prisons for the Progressive magazine for about 8 years. I've done reporting on restraint chairs, on stun belts, on HIV treatment in prisons and jails, and other issues too. And so when I heard about Abu Ghraib, and actually I was on vacation when this story broke, and so I was hearing bits and pieces of it, and I also heard people expressing anger, people around me, that this was happening. And when I started, you know, one of the first things I saw was the photo that is now quite famous of someone who's wearing a hood and a robe and who's strung with electrical wiring. When I saw that, the first thing I thought of was the Sacramento County City Jail. That I had seen video footage of jailers at that jail on a particular shift, a night shift, who were basically, when people were disobedient, in one case, one man had asked for his lawyer repeatedly, and they told him to stop asking for his lawyer, asking to speak to his lawyer. They would, the deputies there would put a spit mask on a person, which is something they can't see through, and pull them into a restraint chair, strap them in, and then in numerous cases told them they were about to be electrocuted. At least in some cases, told them they were about to be electrocuted. So this photo seemed familiar to me. It seemed, and then the more stories I heard, the more I thought, well, you know, this sounds American. It sounds like our prisons and jails, and I don't think we should be too surprised that we've exported that.
You go on to list numerous details of similarities. But before we move on to some of the others, I wanted to ask you about this one in Sacramento, because there was a lawsuit,
right.
You mentioned, and I was wondering if you knew what the outcome of that was.
It led to a settlement, and a very large settlement, on behalf of the people who had been put in restraint chairs. I mean, just to be a little more detailed about that lawsuit, it's more detailed than is in this article. There were people who were put in that restraint chair who were brought into the jail, and they'd been charged with being drunk in public, and in some cases those charges were later dropped. There were people who were put in the restraint chair there who were put in because they were depressed, or there were people who were put in there, their faces covered with a spit mask, and who were screaming, you know, don't let me die, don't let me die. And in one case, there was a man who was strapped into a restraint chair in 96. His name was Carmelo Marrero, who was in the restraint chair who I believe, if I remember rightly, was on drugs and who died after being strapped to that restraint chair. So it was a complicated case, but one of the things that was familiar to me was this fact that they were masked, and then that the guards performed mock executions on them. That's something that, you know, the Guardian of London reported that it had learned. It reported on May 14th that it had learned of ordinary soldiers who were taught to perform mock executions. So that statement too reminded me of the jail.
There's also the pictures that we're all familiar with of inmates being, I'm not sure what the right word for it, but we'll say abused, using dogs. And that reminded you of another case in the United States?
In fact, those were the two incidents that made me decide to do this story. In the United States, a few years ago, there was a big news story. It ended up on the television of about this training video used at Brazoria County Detention Center, which is in Texas. And it showed, as part of the training video, guards using dogs to threaten and bite inmates. And it also had footage of beatings and stun gun use, but the dogs were one of the big things that caught the eye of the media at that point. So that when Seymour Hersh did his amazing reporting for The New Yorker about Abu Ghraib, and one of the things he was pointing out was that these dogs were being used to bite inmates, that, seemed very similar to a famous incident here in the United States.
And this goes on and on and on in your article. There are countless examples of similarities.
Right. What I did was approach my editor and say, look, there are a lot of similarities from my first look at this. It just seems as though we can look through these reports, and we're probably going to find more. And that's really what I did, was start looking, for instance, at shackling, looking at things like long-term solitary confinement, and also urination policies. I mean, basically, here in the United States, when I had done reporting on the restraint chair, I had incidents where people were being strapped in the chair and then forced to defecate on themselves or urinate on themselves. And in at least one case, it was actually jail policy. That was in Ventura County, California. And it was another lawsuit that led to a preliminary injunction banning the chair in that county. But it was, according to that lawsuit, according to that preliminary injunction, jail policy allowed deputies to require restrained arrestees to either urinate or defecate on themselves and be forced to sit in their own feces or hold it. Now, you know, both in this case and in the case in Sacramento, we're not always talking about people who've gone through the whole trial system and been convicted. We're talking about people arrested in some cases and not, you know, not yet proven guilty. But in Iraq, there were a number of incidents involving people who were said they had to urinate where they sat. That included in Abu Ghraib, allegedly Charles Grainer, who's the famous guard, one of the famous guards, who was, according to news reports, very much feared by the prisoners there. He had handcuffed one man to the corner of the bed where he had to stay for days.
This is in the United States?
No, this one is in Abu Ghraib. This is Charles Grainer.
Oh, okay. But you were able to discovered something about his past as well, and that was that he had some experience in this area prior to that in the American prison system.
Yeah, two of the guards at Abu Ghraib had careers as corrections officers here in the United States, and Charles Grainer had worked at Greene County Prison in Pennsylvania, which was the location of a lawsuit involving 12 different guards. And one of the things I was interested in was whether anything similar had happened at Greene County Prison that was similar to Abu Ghraib. Now, I should say at the outset that Grainer was never implicated in this lawsuit, but he was there at the time. He was sued by an inmate who accused him of beatings and other mistreatment, but that suit ended up being dismissed. However, just to go through the similarities between Abu Ghraib and Greene.
Right.
At Abu Ghraib, according to the Army report, there was credible evidence that an inmate had suffered forced sodomy with a chemical light or perhaps a broom handle. And there were the arrangements of people in sexually explicit positions for photographing and basically public display. Also forcing groups of male detainees to masturbate themselves, for photography and videotape. And there were beatings, and this is all allegations, but according to the Army, and also guards wrote insulting epithets on their bodies. Well, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in 1998 reported at Greene that, and this will sound familiar, guards sodomized inmates with nightsticks, conducted nude searches and in full view of other guards and prisoners, and in those searches examined every bodily orifice. And there was also an allegation that guards had used the blood of one inmate to write KKK on the floor. The very specificity of the similarities of those two, you know, places, one here in the United States, the other in Iraq, kind of shocked me, frankly. And in putting those two things next to each other so that we can see the similarities, I wasn't trying to accuse Grainer of being guilty at Greene. What I'm trying to point out is that, you know, he, at the very least, moved from a prison where there was known abuse to another. And Abu Ghraib was a familiar environment. He's part of a system. And that, in some ways, is what I'm trying to argue in the article, that we have a system here in the United States where there have been repeated incidents of abuse, and we shouldn't really be shocked when we find that things like that are happening in Iraq.
In light of that, it's easy to see, I guess, that or reasonable to conclude, I should say, that there's a more systemic a problem.
One of the things, and this is not in my article, but one of the things that's repeatedly said about Abu Ghraib is that there are problems with oversight, that the prison was crowded, and that the guards were frightened, probably. The things I know about the American prison system suggest that those three things may be problems also. On oversight, I guess you'd have to go prison by prison, but I do know that in American jails, for instance, their policies on restraint chair use are all over the place. There are many, many different kinds of policies. Many of our jails and prisons are overcrowded. Many of them have mentally ill inmates. I've been in, like, my local jail, for instance, where, you know, I could hear screaming continually because the man who was screaming was mentally ill. And in those kinds of situations, and in situations where, like at Maricopa County Jail in Phoenix, where inmates are housed in tent cities and it gets very hot, those situations can be frightening for guards. They have a lot to deal with. And I think that's part of the similarity between Abu Ghraib and the U.S. also.
My instinct when I hear things like this is to immediately blame the guards.
Yeah, I mean, I there are people certainly responsible for things, but one of the things I was talking about in the article is that that really we've had a cultural shift here in the United States. I think guards work in very difficult situations. I know there are a lot of guards who do have they believe in rehabilitation, and they believe in some of the old methods, and so I guess I don't think all guards are implicated in this. And now there are some bad guards, certainly, and you know there's certainly evidence of that. But I do think that when we have here in the United States, this was a country where we really led the way in prison reform long ago, back around the Revolutionary War time, but and for a couple hundred years after that. And now we're leading the way, and we really are. Other countries are following suit. In a different direction. Since the 1990s, since the early 1990s, we've had kind of a militarization of our prisons and jails, and that's even apparent in juvenile programs. For instance, we have, you know, boot camps are very popular, and they were, especially in the 1990s, but there have been kids who died at some of those boot camp programs. I went to a law enforcement conference in 1996 that was sponsored by the American Defense Preparedness Association, which was used to sponsoring, you know, other conferences like Bomb and Warhead. So there's a really different way of thinking about prisoners here in the United States than we used to have. And to me, that all signals that we're thinking about a war here in the United States, and that prisoners are the public enemy. And that also suggests that they can't be rehabilitated. There's something else going on in our culture. If you turn on the television any night during, you know, primetime programming, what you're going to come across, even if you're just flipping through, are crime and punishment shows. That's also true of video games. A lot of them talk about punishment. I feel that publicly, we Americans have a new set of beliefs, really, and those are that people who land in jail deserve to be there, that criminals are bad people, that they can't be rehabilitated, that punishment should therefore be as harsh as possible, and basically we don't need to know the details and we don't want to. I was trying to partly to explain to myself why, you know, I've been reporting on this for 8 years. I have seen photos, and we've published some of them, very disturbing photos. I was on a Nightline program that showed videotapes of people being put in restraint chairs that showed bruise marks from some of these devices. I was amazed. You know, Nightline, Ted Koppel's Nightline really does great reporting. And some of, you know, some of these photos have been on our television, but they don't get quite the publicity that Abu Ghraib got. And I was really trying to understand why. Because, you know, to me, seeing those things was very, very disturbing, and they haven't gotten the kind of, they haven't led to public outcry in the same way that Abu Ghraib did.
You often hear police spokespeople, when discussing crime in more general terms, refer to, and this is something I've come across, I'm certain you have as well, which is they refer to certain people as bad guys. And I guess that supports what you're saying.
Yeah, that's a very interesting way of talking that I think is somewhat new, although I don't have proof of it. But, bad guys.
In you made some other specific connections. Another appalling one was an example in Utah, and you were also able to link this to an individual who was involved in that prison system and who later on went to work in Iraq at Abu Ghraib.
Right. Back in 2000, when I did reporting on the restraint chair, I found a case of a man named Michael Valente, who was a mentally ill man who was placed into a restraint chair nude, spent 16 hours there and in 1997, and he got up after being in the restraint chair and took a shower and died from a clot that went to his lungs, blood clot. He was in the prison at a time that a man named Lane McCotter, who was head of Department of Corrections in Utah, and after Valente died, McCotter resigned. McCotter, 6 years later, was in charge of reconstructing Abu Ghraib, and he has denied involvement in those abuses. But my point was, again, not that he was personally responsible, but that he's part of a system that we've really, a well-established system here in the U.S. that we have exported, we are exporting to Iraq. There was another incident that Amnesty International reported that happened while McCotter was head of Department of Corrections in Utah. And that's of another inmate who was shackled to a steel board on a cell floor. These are called restraint boards, and inmates are either shackled face down or face up.
How common is that?
My experience is that it's very common. I haven't done reporting on those, but I've looked into it, and I've seen them. They're at my local jail. They brought them out to show me. In fact, in Utah, or is it, no, in Colorado, I believe, I may be wrong on this, but I believe it was Pueblo County, they banned the restraint chair and brought in the restraint board as a substitute for it. They're kind of used as substitutes for each other. They're, you know, one of the things I have to say with these devices is that in a situation where corrections officers feel overwhelmed by having to deal with a lot of mentally ill inmates, who maybe should not be in the prison or jails, that one way of dealing with them that seems safer is to put them on one of these devices. Unfortunately, sometimes there are struggles that result from that, and there have been deaths connected with struggles like that. But, yeah, from what I understand, these devices, these boards, are very common. In the Utah State Prison case, this guy was shackled to this in what's called a four-point restraint. It was either four or five-point restraint. That means he was tied down at four parts of his body for 12 weeks in 1995.
Did at any point when you were being shown these devices, did anyone defend their use in any terms that seemed reasonable to you? Or
I actually have spoken to the makers of these devices, and my impression of both the restraint chair and even the stun belt, which is another device I've reported on, is that the makers believe they were creating humane devices and that they served a purpose. Especially in a crowded jail or a prison, so that, you know, when I spoke with Dan Corcoran, who's the maker of restraint chair, and it's the AEDEC restraint chair, which is the one most commonly used here, and as far as I know, it's also used in Canada. I've heard that it's being used in Newfoundland, for instance, and that there was some outcry there when that was brought in, but we were the leaders in the restraint chair, and it's used in booking rooms, in particular in jails across the country. And one of the things Dan Corcoran will say is that when a prisoner is struggling and frightened, and you cup him gently and just like a hand holding a frightened bird, and you restrain him that way, that he will calm down. And so, you know, for him, it was an improvement. He will say that it was an improvement on restraint boards because it was holding people upright. And he says that's safer. They won't choke on their vomit, for instance. I have no way of evaluating that specific claim. What I do know is that when I did reporting on the restraint chair, I found 11 deaths of inmates. This was back in 2000. Who had been held on the restraint chair and then they died either on the restraint chair or shortly thereafter. Amnesty International started looking at that after I did that reporting, and they found another 5 in the next year, or another 4 in the next year. This led the United Nations Committee Against Torture to ask the United States to ban that device as well as the stun belt, and that has not happened. But for the makers, they really do believe they're creating devices that help police officers and that cause fewer deaths.
Another similarity that you noted in your article was the treatment of women, specifically women who were abused sexually or raped. And you found, once again, that incidents such as this occur all too frequently in the United States.
Right. Well, there in Abu Ghraib, in addition to all the allegations, mostly allegations involved men, but the Guardian, the London-based Guardian, reported that senior U.S. military officials had told journalists that rape had happened in the cell block, in a particular cell block where there were also some high-value male detainees. This was back in May. And that, I knew there was a big problem with rape in the United States. So when I saw that, I didn't really have to go very far to find that. We had done some reporting at the Progressive back in 96, and this was not my reporting, but that of a woman named Bobby Stein, about guards who were letting inmates into women's cells, sometimes in exchange for payment. And you know, if you just look at Amnesty International reports, particularly those on women, that organization reported back in 1999 that many women in prisons and jails in the United States are victims of sexual abuse. That includes everything from offensive language to rape. So yeah, that's common.
Another thing that jumped out at me in your article was the use of a restraint pole.
This was one I particularly looked up because I knew we were using shackles a lot, and it was very interesting that Amnesty International, in looking at Abu Ghraib, called attention to shackling. Because if you look at the United States, we use shackles really as a matter of course. It's commonly used. So that... And these are also Amnesty International reports from 1998, but women who are brought into the hospital who are in labor, in some cases even dying, may be shackled. And there are other incidents where, you know, not it's not a restraint chair, but it's long-term shackling. So in Alabama, there were prisoners tied to something called a hitching rail, but it was basically a kind of restraint pole where they would spend hours. And this was in particular at Julie Tutwiler Prison for Women in Alabama, where they'd been handcuffed to that rail for up to a day.
There are also cases of people being held in solitary confinement or other kinds of isolation for extended periods of time that, once again, you were able to make a connection.
When it comes to things like solitary confinement, and I've done a lot of reporting on that, because actually I did some reporting right after 2001, or September 11th, 2001. We got a letter from Frida Berrigan, who the daughter of Phil Berrigan, the famous peace activist, and she was unable to contact her father right after September 11th. The reason was that prisoners who were considered political prisoners were thrown into solitary confinement right after the attack on the World Trade Center. This applied to people all across the country. Even someone like Phil Berrigan, who is a pacifist and has never done anything knowingly violent. He was in prison for hammering on a, I believe it was a Air Force plane. And a lot of those people stayed in solitary for months. But, you know, when I saw the Red Cross report saying, you know, one of their complaints was that people were kept in solitary for 24 hours for long periods of time, it's not a funny thing, and yet it struck me as almost humorous, because here in the United States, that is par for the course at our supermaxes. It is part of our culture at this point that we have a significant portion of the our prisoners who are kept in solitary for 23 hours a day. They get 1 hour of exercise, and basically for much of their prison sentence. Here in Wisconsin, very close to here, is a supermax built in a little tiny town called Boscobel. A few years ago, in 2001, there was a class action lawsuit that was filed by those inmates. And they claimed that the facility was what they called, quote, an incubator of psychosis, end quote. There were mentally ill people being kept at that facility, and also juveniles. So I called up Ed Garvey, who's a well-known lawyer here in my state, who talked about that case. There was a court order as a result of the case that resulted in the removal of all mentally ill inmates, which he said was about a third of the prisoners kept at that facility. And he said to me, well, it's pretty interesting that the International Red Cross is upset with prisoners being held that long in solitary, because that's the case at Boscobel every day. So, you know, we actually violate the Geneva Conventions, which don't apply to American prisons,
right.
But it gives you a measuring stick. One of the things the Red Cross was also finding was that it looked like solitary confinement was contributing to psychological problems among the prisons that although they also found that the interrogation was causing symptoms.
Just to clear one thing up, supermaxes,
yes,
are what exactly?
Well, our supermaxes, it's interesting that we're not a leader. That we're not the only country with these things now. My impression is that in general with these devices that seem less humane, that might have been outlawed at different time in U.S. history, that we're a leader in the shift toward them, but that other countries are following suit. But with what I called supermaxes, these are ultra-high security prisons that are supposedly designed to house the worst of the worst. My impression from the Boscobel case is that that's not always true, that there was a man, a boy, named Canyon Thixton, who had taken a car on a joyride. He was from a little rural town here called Mount Horeb, who went to a prison, went to prison for this, but ended up at the Bosco Bell Supermax because he would fight with guards. So, but he was a juvenile, and he also became very suicidal while he was at the Supermax.
What can be done other than, you know, what we're doing here, telling people about them, these conditions? What can we do as individuals to ensure that prisoners are not treated in such a horrific manner?
I'm not sure how it is in Canada, as far as the public interest in the welfare of prisoners. I would say here, one of the things that has to start is that we have to think that that they're worth our time and our attention. Because many of these prisoners come back into our communities, and if they're mistreated and dehumanized in our prisons, that's a memory they bring back. And, you know, the quality of our society involves these people who are in our jails and prisons. I also think that, you know, the public here in the United States, the public sort of tough on crime talk, that a lot of it's in the pundits who are on television, the politicians, that is contributing to a feeling that these prisoners deserve this treatment. And if enough members of the public start pointing out that they don't, that could have a change too. But it's going to take time, and it's going to take a true public and cultural turnaround, at least in the United States.
That was investigative reporter Anne-Marie Cusack of the Progressive magazine, speaking with Ron Anichich of CKLN in Toronto. You can read her article at www.progressive.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1, KFAR Knoxville at 90.9, or Free Radio Olympia 91.3. We'll be back with updates on repression in New York City and an interview with the author of a guidebook designed to help protesters know their rights when dealing with the police. Here's a timely song by Olympia, Washington musician Andrus Jones.
Give us the chance. participate in this pacifying dance. Hold your nose and vote, yeah. Hold your nose and vote, yeah. Keep that file down in your throat as you hold your nose and vote. Now if you want parades, we got parades. We got parades all day. You want TV, we got more shows than you could ever bear to see. But if you want what's right, yeah, if your appetite is for what is just, then I'm afraid tonight you're going hungry with the rest of us until every couple of years we give you the chance. Participate in this pacifying dance. Hold your nose and vote, yeah. Hold your nose and vote, yeah. Keep that file down in your throat as you hold your nose and cast your vote.
Even as New York City's Republican mayor and his coterie of billionaires have been planning a big party for the Republican National Convention, which begins next week, many city residents have spent more than a year planning to unwelcome the Republicans. Many suspect the timing of the convention as an attempt by the Bush campaign to evoke the 9/11 attacks that changed the Bush image overnight from a bumbler to a war president. A variety of groups are planning everything from marches to art shows, and these arrangements have been met with what seems like unprecedented state repression.